This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Monday, Hong Kong protesters extract a back down of sorts and an apology from their political leader. But for how long can they stave off Beijing's control? And are we pushing too many of our children into university courses when they're not suited to them?
We seem to be fixated with young people going through a university pathway. I know a lot of parents have aspirations for their young people to do better than they did, and university seems to be the panacea.
From this week, Victorians who have fatal illnesses will have the right to choose the timing of their death. The State Premier says Victoria's euthanasia laws are conservative and provide safeguards to protect vulnerable people. And other states are already looking to follow Victoria's lead. In Melbourne, Connie Agius reports.
68-year-old Ingrid Eifler from Newcastle has lung cancer, and her doctors say she has 6 months to live.
Wished I could die, you know, and have it over and done with. I'm sick of my life. I'm just sitting down on the chair, looking out the door. If I do something, I get breathless. I'm not in a good way doing things.
Ingrid Eifler is now looking south, towards Victoria, as it's set to legalise euthanasia later this week. She's hoping her home state of New South Wales, at some stage, will follow.
I wished I wouldn't have to go through all this, you know. I wished I could go to Melbourne and I would pay the government or whatever for it, as what they wanted to do for me in Switzerland, because Switzerland's very far away.
The euthanasia debate is already underway in New South Wales. Trevor Khan is a member of the Legislative Council in the state's parliament.
A bill has previously been introduced and was lost in the Legislative Council by one vote. The intention of the members of the working group that introduced that bill was for a fresh bill to be introduced into the new parliament. Our original intention was to do it towards the end of this year, taking into account the timing of what's happened in Victoria.
But Trevor Khan says things have changed since the last vote in New South Wales.
One is there's been a change in the nature of the parliament as a whole. Certainly there's been significant changes in the makeup of the Legislative Council. But again, I think now that the legislation is coming into effect in Victoria, legislators will be more informed about how the system works and the sort of people who are seeking to access it. And so hopefully it will take some of the emotive elements out of the debate and have people more concentrate on the reality.
Other states are also headed down the legally assisted dying path. A Queensland parliamentary inquiry is looking at the issue. The West Australian government will introduce a voluntary assisted dying bill in August. Rosalind McDonald is a senior lecturer in health ethics at the University of Melbourne.
So in the Victorian system, there's been various decisions made about what will be appropriate safeguards, and each of those has a kind of access consequence. So I think for other states and territories to see how that plays out in Victoria will inform their own decision making. I think the other thing to be really aware of in other states is the fact that this type of law doesn't just impact on senior doctors. In Victoria, the system is that two senior doctors involved in the eligibility assessment and the process with a patient, but it's from the research that we've been doing in hospitals, it's very clear that this is a process that has an impact, a much broader impact than that.
Voluntary assisted dying will become legal in Victoria this Wednesday, and only people who have lived in Victoria for at least 12 months are eligible.
Connie Agius in Melbourne. Let's go now to Hong Kong, where the Chief Executive Carrie Lam has today personally apologised over her handling of an extradition bill, which sparked one of the most violent protests in the city in decades. Her comments come a day after she indefinitely suspended the bill, which would allow Hong Kong citizens to be sent to mainland China for trial.
I feel deep sorrow and regret that the deficiencies in our work and various other factors have stirred up substantial controversies and dispute in society following the relatively calm periods of the past 2 years. disappointing many people. We will adopt the most sincere and humble attitude to accept criticisms and make improvements so that we can continue to connect with the people of Hong Kong.
This apology came as hundreds of thousands of black-clad protesters went onto the streets again, maintaining calls for Ms. Lam to resign and for the bill to be not just suspended but withdrawn. Dr. Pooja Kapai is the Deputy Director of the Centre for Comparative and Public Law at the University of Hong Kong, and she joined me a short time ago. Dr. Kapai, welcome to The World Today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hong Kong's Chief Executive Carrie Lam has now apologised for police violence against the protesters and has suspended but not withdrawn the extradition bill. Why do you think Carrie Lam has even backed down to this extent?
Well, I think there really can't be a stronger verdict in terms of her governance strategies than 1 million people coming out on last Sunday, and then everything that happened with hundreds and thousands of people on the streets on Wednesday and yesterday, I mean, with a march of nearly 2 million people. 2 million is about 30% of the population of Hong Kong. We've never seen anything like this ever in the history of Hong Kong protests. And we've certainly never seen such a strong read in terms of people being publicly willing to put themselves out there and make it very clear where they stand. So I think the build-up post-Wednesday was very, very significant, such that she had no real choice but to take it into account before the public anger boiled over and to sort of step back.
Last week you were saying that you were certain this bill would go through the parliament. Are you surprised to see the number of people still willing to go out onto the streets to push for the withdrawal of this bill?
I would say that after Wednesday, I'm not surprised, because I think the response was orchestrated, and some of the scenes we saw really foreshadowed what we've seen this weekend and what's coming today, and I think in the coming weeks until the bill is withdrawn. So I think that things really seem to have boiled over, and you see the opposition basically riding that wave and now insisting that they go all the way through and that this bill just can't be kept alive.
What is the likelihood that Carrie Lam will now go further and withdraw that bill altogether?
It's extremely difficult to say, because, I mean, I think it really comes down to whether the government will actively sort of take that step, because that would signify that they acknowledge that they've really read the situation completely wrongly. It basically has taken so much to extract an apology. It makes it very difficult to gauge whether the government's going to actively do something. I mean, we know that the government could, in theory, put the bill back on the cards by giving 12 days notice to the president of the Legislative Council. And if it doesn't do so, it has, I mean, the bill can stay alive up until 2020 in July, when the current LegCo's term will expire. So either the government can actively withdraw and say, we're not going to push this bill further, or it could just let it lapse and sort of have a natural death. My read, based on the events in the past week, is that the government's likely to let things lapse, because it would be very humiliating and really shameful, I think, if the government feels it would be humiliating and shameful to have to step up and say, okay, we now see how bad this is, so we're going to withdraw the bill.
What is the risk, though, of simply suspending the bill?
It means that there's only 12 days notice that's required, and that's enough to get it back on the agenda of the Legislative Council. And so the worry is suspension at this point is not enough, given the divisions and the huge concerns that people have.
Is there any chance that Carrie Lam would defy the leadership in China, or would China's president have to be signalling that he supports what she's been doing?
From the way in which she's governed so far, I'd have to say it's highly unlikely that she would defy the Chinese government. But there's also this confusion surrounding whether the bill was her own initiative and whether it was the Chinese government's, right? Because it could really be both working in tandem. But I think that insofar as the Chinese government is concerned, they are adamant and determined to back whatever moves the city's leader will make. And I think they're pretty confident that they've got the right person for the job.
Hong Kong is a key financial centre for China, though. I mean, how worried do you think the leadership in China is about this situation with so many people on the streets?
I think it's very, very concerned. The public face of the sort of Chinese government stance is that, you know, we've got things under control and we won't interfere. But I think it is very, very deeply concerned. You know, the situation is more complex than just Hong Kong alone, because we know on a global level, with the trade war with the US, there's a lot riding as well for the Chinese government to sort of exercise some bandwidth in terms of how it chooses to deal with the situation it sees in Hong Kong. I do think it's reassuring, though, that even though there's a 2 million strong protest on the street last night, that it was still largely peaceful. I think it would be probably much, much more serious if we saw anything in the shape of what we saw on Wednesday.
What do you think would happen then?
It's really difficult to say. I mean, I hesitate to even think about it, given what we've seen is possible in light of 1989 with Tiananmen and with the hard line we saw the police take on Wednesday. I really do think that the government, the Chinese government certainly would be prepared to quell anything that they would see. You can see from the way that they labeled Wednesday's protest a riot. They're very quick to sort of take that position. They can't afford the risk of a mass uprising anywhere in China. And I think giving Hong Kong too much leeway would make the leadership concerned that that then could be a possibility that might materialize elsewhere.
Dr. Kapai, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's Dr. Pooja Kapai from the University of Hong Kong. To politics back home now, and the Federal Labor Party is calling for an open tender process to decide who provides the security services for asylum seekers on Manus Island. The Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton, has indicated that the government is likely to extend the contract of the current service provider, Paladin, at the end of the month, despite concerns raised about the company and the contract. Now the PNG government is putting pressure on the Australian government to make a change. Political reporter Alexandra Beach has more.
Paladin's contract to run the security services on Manus Island is worth around $20 million of taxpayer money a month. And controversially, it was awarded without the normal open tender process. Now, Labor leader Anthony Albanese says other companies should have a fair shot at taking over the job.
Not a bad idea when you're talking about taxpayers' funds.
Paladin was awarded the lucrative contract nearly 2 years ago. Its contract ends in 2 weeks' time. And yesterday, the Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton told the ABC's Annabelle Crabb that there was unlikely to be a change of hands.
And the department will work with the PNG authorities. We've got to make sure that that we're getting value for money.
But you must know if this is 2 weeks away, what state of play is.
Well, the likely arrangement is that there will be a continuation, but I'm not going to comment when the department's in the process of contract discussions, negotiations, etc.
But last night, Papua New Guinea's Immigration Minister Petrus Thomas issued a written statement saying PNG doesn't want Paladin to continue running the camp after its contract expires. The country's officials have written to Australia's Department of Home Affairs calling for a transparent tender process. And Mr. Thomas says local companies in PNG now have the capacity and the expertise to do the job instead. A spokeswoman for Peter Dutton said he had no further comment, but Anthony Albanese says it's extraordinary for the minister to publicly say Paladin will probably continue in the role before the proper process is completed.
If you're doing a renovation on your house worth $20,000, you don't ring up a bloke and say, well, you're likely to get the contract, but can I talk to you about the details? You actually go out there and you have an open process and you get a few quotes and you take the best deal.
The Auditor General is already investigating the way the Paladin contract was awarded. Today, Mr. Albanese couldn't name any specific concerns with the way Paladin's doing its job on Manus Island, but he says PNG obviously has concerns, and Labor will grill government officials about the value for money being provided during Senate estimates later this year.
Peter Dutton stuffed this up the first time. He had a chance to make it a bit better, and what he's doing is just digging further into the hole. The problem is the taxpayers are paying for that fiscal hole.
In a statement, Paladin Solutions says it delivers all its projects to the highest professional and ethical standards, and its work in PNG demonstrates that.
Alexandra Beach. This is The World Today. The transition from school leaver to university student is a well-worn path for Australians, with 60% of school leavers going on to university before the age of 22. But a Productivity Commission report out today is warning about a surge in dropout numbers. as Isabel Rowe reports.
In the chilly inland town of Dalby in southern Queensland, Dustin Cross is training to be a livestock agent.
We have sort of like a trade school, so twice a year our group of trainees, we get together. There's eight of us. We've just went to a 52,000-head feedlot.
The 22-year-old, who's originally from regional Victoria, started a school-based apprenticeship on a farm in Year 12 while his friends went to uni.
In my era, I see more young people that might have tried a degree for 1 or 2 years, realised that it wasn't their thing and they've tried something different and found agriculture. One of my best friends undertook a sports science degree in Melbourne, did that for 3 years and realised he wanted to become a landscaper.
It's a common story among school leavers. A Productivity Commission report has found about 1 in 5 students who signed up to university as a result of a lift on enrolment caps have failed or dropped out. Gary Workman is the head of the Global Apprenticeship Network, which places students into workplace learning.
We seem to be fixated with young people going through a university pathway. I know a lot of parents have aspirations for their young people to do better than they did, and university seems to be the panacea.
He wants Year 12 students to be better informed about the sort of job they can get without going to university.
So a lot of people think about apprenticeships as being, you know, a bricklayer or a carpenter, but we've got cyber security, we've got IT, we've got health, community services.
I guess this is a bit of a marketing issue then. You need to let people know that this is that you actually can do that.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. And a lot of career advisors are secondary school teachers. They've gone through a university pathway. I'm not blaming them for the situation, but we're leaving the career decisions up to parents and school advisors.
Getting more people into apprenticeships is on the federal government's agenda. In April, the government released a review of the vocational education sector, a report it commissioned from former New Zealand Minister for Tertiary Education, Stephen Joyce. Among his recommendations, Stephen Joyce says the government should better sell the financial benefits of trades.
One of the areas that we tried in New Zealand was linking qualification data with tax data, so you can then go out and say, if you do this qualification, we know that the sort of earnings that those people have got once they've qualified is X.
The Chief Executive of Universities Australia, Katrina Jackson, says the Productivity Commission report doesn't tell the full story about university attrition.
They're just looking at students under 22 years of age. If you just look at one of those groups, Indigenous students, a third of the Indigenous students who are studying in universities, those numbers have doubled, by the way.
Joyce Review author Stephen Joyce believes there is already enough federal funding to get more people into apprenticeships. It's just a matter of will.
Isabel Rowe reporting. Construction lawyers are warning that flaws in the way the building industry is run will lead to more problems, like the serious cracking issues that are already being seen in some new apartments in Australia. Stephanie Smale has our report.
As the residents of the Mascot Towers development briefly return home to collect their belongings, then leave again, lawyers and industry experts are warning the current system will let this happen again and again. Construction lawyer Bronwyn Weir co-authored a report in 2017 outlining 24 recommendations to overhaul the industry. She says she's not aware of any of them being adopted.
And there is this thing called value engineering where as the project's the design is being developed, there is a strong desire to cut cost, and so engineers are asked to find ways to design the building with cheaper construction costs, and that can sometimes have a compromise on safety, or they can choose designs which are cheaper to build but more expensive to maintain. And there certainly was a lot of reports to us around those sorts of practices.
Less than 6 months ago, the Opal Tower building in Sydney's Olympic Park was evacuated after the building shifted, and it was later found poor design and materials were to blame. In Melbourne, earlier this year, hundreds of residents had to leave their high-rise home after a fire sparked concerns with the building's cladding. Bronwyn Weir points out the current system doesn't hold those who design, build and check the structures to account.
part of this is trying to balance interest from the insurance market to support the industry, which is really important, and that is quite precarious at the moment. There already is no warranty insurance product for buildings over three storey, and there's been lots of media and attention recently to professional indemnity insurance for the consultants becoming quite precarious and insurers pulling out of that market. So it is a delicate balance. Governments can make people responsible and liable, but if there's not an insurance product or governments don't put up some sort of insurance regime to support it, the accountability is pretty limited.
It's not just Victoria and New South Wales having problems. James Nicholas from the Strata Community Association spent 10 years working as a lawyer dealing with apartment defects in Queensland. He points out buyers looking at new properties are often blind to the potential problems and their lack of options if something does go wrong.
When you look at what the volume of documentation is that somebody gets when they buy off the plan, it's easy for things to get missed in the ocean of paperwork that they're given. People fall in love with the glossy pictures and it's maybe not front of mind to be critical and go, okay, what could go wrong with this building?
He argues the process of holding builders, engineers and designers to account is too complicated and expensive. He says the period owners or occupiers have to take action in Queensland is just over 6 years, and builders are often only contractually obligated to fix problems for about a year.
And in many cases, the original owner is in control of all or most of the stock during that 1 year period, and both people buy in after that, and sometimes the right can be gone.
State and Territory building ministers are due to meet next month with their federal counterpart, Karen Andrews.
Stephanie Smale reporting. Australians are continuing to lose extraordinary amounts of money from sophisticated scammers claiming to be from the National Broadband Network. The Consumer Watchdog says that the average monthly loss so far this year is $110,000. That's an increase of nearly 300% on last year. ACCC Acting Chair Delia Rickard has been speaking with the ABC's Senior Business Correspondent, Peter Ryan.
It's way, way too much. 531,000 has gone missing, and it's to a range of different scams where scammers pretend to be the NBN to get both your money and your personal information.
How many people have been conned by NBN scammers? And just explain how these scammers work in getting people to hand over sensitive identification details like addresses, dates of birth, Medicare card numbers.
So far we've had nearly 5,000 people report scams to us. Now, not all of those will have lost money, but that many people have taken the time and effort to let us know about scams approaching them. One really unusual one in terms of ID theft is people are turning up at someone's door, pretending to be the NBN, and then asking for a whole range of personal information. Driver's licence, passport number, Medicare number. Now, you should never, ever give away personal information to someone but you haven't approached yourself and you're not completely confident of who they are.
So it's gone from unsolicited telephone calls from people claiming to be from the NBN to someone actually turning up at your doorstep.
Turning up at your doorstep, which is quite unusual. We don't see that with many scams. And the main scam we're seeing here is the remote access scam, where scammers pretend to be the NBN. They call you and tell you that there's a problem with your computer. They either offer to fix it, download malware onto your machine where they can then get all sorts of personal identification information, or they do the threat thing where they say that someone's maliciously attacked your computer, we need your help to track them, and then they trick you into giving them access to your bank accounts, amongst other things.
And you say that people over the age of 65 are the most vulnerable, taking the greater share of the losses.
That's right, and we suspect part of the reason for that is that they're more likely to still have a landline, to be at home and answer the phone during the day. Interestingly, this is one of the few scams where we haven't had any reports from people under 35. And again, probably a lot of them are just using mobiles.
Where are these scammers located? Where are they operating from? And how difficult is it for law enforcement authorities to track them down?
The vast majority of them are based overseas. It's incredibly difficult and incredibly resource intensive to track them down. So we really try to get the message out so we can warn people about the ways in which scammers are operating, so that hopefully they that they just won't fall victim to one of these scams.
It's not just the NBN scam, though. You've had cases where scammers call during a blackout and offer a way to stay connected, of course, for a fee.
They call and they say, look, if you pay us this much money, then we can ensure you remain connected to the NBN during blackouts. And, of course, the NBN uses electricity, and so it is affected by blackouts.
Just how serious are these scams becoming? Because people are now much more aware of them, yet people are still being conned.
I think one of the very clever things that scammers do is they constantly reinvent the same old scams but attach them to current topical issues. We know there's a degree of confusion with people, so another version of the NBN scams is they call offering to sell you various equipment, modems, this and that, and then they'll either get you to pay over iTunes cards or some sort of gift cards, or hand over your bank account details or credit card numbers. So it's important for people to remember that the NBN is a wholesaler. They are not out there calling, trying to sell you equipment.
We all need to be on guard. The ACCC's Delia Rickard with Senior Business Correspondent Peter Ryan. And that's all from the World Today team for this Monday. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Having power.
I've answered the question the way I choose to answer the question.
Getting what you want.
This can provide endless possibilities.
It can be positive.
There will be no cover.
Or negative.
When an individual portfolio is blowing up.
Money, position.
I'm a fixer, Madam Speaker.
Influence.
Who do you think you are?
Power in Australia. How does it work? Who has it? How is it constrained?
Never again.
We go to the top and begin in Canberra. Who runs this place? Get it now, wherever you find your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.